It was time to change the subject before our current one gave V even more wild ideas. Like the fact that my new chemistry partner is Marcy Miller? The hoe? Apparently she's filing for the front office, and she looked in Patch's file. Is it still empty? It looks that way, since she wants me to tell her everything I know about him, including why he was hanging out in her driveway last night, gazing at her bedroom window. I'd once heard a rumor that Marcy propped a tennis racket in her window when she was open to payment for certain services, but I wasn't going to think about that. Weren't rumors 90% fiction anyway? V leaned in closer. What do you know? Our conversation lapsed into an uncomfortable silence. I didn't believe in secrets between best friends, but there are secrets, and there are hard truths. Scary truths. Unimaginable truths. Having a boyfriend who's a fallen-turned guardian angel fits into all of the above. You're keeping something from me, said V. I'm not. Are too. Thick silence. I told Patch I loved him. V covered her mouth, but I couldn't tell if she was stifling a gasp or laughter, which only made me feel more insecure. Was it that funny? Had I done something even stupider than I already thought? What did he say? V asked. I merely looked at her. That bad? She asked. I cleared my voice. Tell me about this guy you're after. I mean, is this a lust from afar thing, or have you actually talked to him? V took the hint. Talk to him? I had hot dogs at Skippy's with him yesterday for lunch. It was one of those blind date things, and it turned out better than expected. Much better. FYI, you'd know all this stuff if you returned my calls instead of making out with your boyfriend nonstop. V, I'm your only friend, and it wasn't me who hooked you up. I know. Your boyfriend did. I choked on a gorgonzola cheese ball. Patch set you up on a blind date? Yeah, so? V said, her tone edging toward defensive. I smiled. I thought you didn't trust Patch. I don't. But? I tried calling you to vet my date first, but to repeat, you never return my calls anymore. Mission accomplished. I feel like the worst friend ever. I gave her a conspirator's smile. Now tell me the rest. V's resistant tone dropped away, and she mirrored my smile. His name is Rickson, and he's Irish. His brogue, or whatever it's called, kills me. Sexy to the max. He's a little on the skinny side, considering I'm big-boned, but I'm planning on losing 20 pounds this summer, so everything should even out by August. Rickson? No way! I love Rickson! As a standard rule, I didn't trust fallen angels, but Rickson was an exception. Like Patch, his moral boundaries were drawn in the gray area between black and white. He wasn't perfect, but he wasn't all bad either. I grinned, pointing my fork at V. I can't believe you went out with him. I mean, he's Patch's best friend. You hate Patch. V gave me her black cat look, her hair practically bristling. Best friends doesn't mean anything. Look at you and me. We are nothing alike. This is great. The four of us can hang out all summer. No way. I'm not hanging out with that whack job boyfriend of yours. I don't care what you told me. I still think he had something to do with Jules's mysterious death in the gym. A dark cloud fell on the conversation. There had been only three people in the gym the night Jules died, and I was one of them. I'd never told V everything that happened, just enough to get her to stop pressing. And for her own safety, I planned on keeping it that way. V and I spent the day driving around, picking up employment applications from local fast food joints, and it was nearly 6:30 when I got home. I dropped my keys on the sideboard and checked the answering machine for messages. There was one from my mom. She was at Michu's Market picking up garlic bread, deli lasagna, and cheap wine, and swore on her grave she would beat the Parnells to the house. I deleted the message and climbed upstairs to my bedroom. Since I'd missed my morning shower and my hair had frizzed to maximum height during the day, I figured I'd change into clean clothes by way of damage control. Every single memory I had of Scott Parnell was unpleasant, but company was company. I had my cardigan halfway unbuttoned when there was a rap at the front door. I found Patch on the other side of it, hands in his pockets. Normally I would have greeted him by bounding straight into his arms. Today I held back. Last night I'd said I loved him, and he'd bolted and allegedly headed straight for Marcy's house. My mood fell somewhere between injured pride, anger, and insecurity. I hoped my reserved silence sent him a message that something was off, and would be until he made a move to correct it, either by apology or explanation. "Hey," I said, assuming casualness. "You forgot to call last night. Where did you end up going?"
"Around. You going to invite me in?"
I didn't. "I'm glad to hear Marcy's house is just, you know, around." A momentary flick of surprise in his eyes confirmed what I didn't want to believe. Marcy had been telling the truth. "Wanna tell me what's going on?" I said in a slightly more hostile tone. "Wanna tell me what you were doing at her place last night?"
"You sound jealous, Angel."
There might have been a note of teasing behind it, but unlike usual, there was nothing affectionate or playful about it. "Maybe I wouldn't be jealous if you didn't give me a reason to be," I shot back. "What were you doing at her house?"
"Taking care of business."
I swept my eyebrows up. "I didn't realize you and Marcy had business."
"We do, but it's just that. Business."
"Care to elaborate?" There was a heavy dose of allegation crammed between my actual words.
"Are you accusing me of something?"
"Should I be?" Patch was usually expert at hiding his emotions, but the line of his mouth tightened.
"No."
"If being at her house last night was so innocent, why are you having such a hard time explaining what you were doing there?"
"I'm not having a hard time," he said, each word carefully measured. "I'm not telling you, because what I was doing at Marcy's has nothing to do with us."
How could he think this didn't have anything to do with us? Marcy was the one person who took every opportunity to attack and belittle me. Over the past 11 years, she'd teased me, spread horrible rumors about me, and humiliated me publicly. How could he think this wasn't personal? How could he think I'd just accept this, no questions asked? Above all, couldn't he see I was terrified that Marcy would use him to hurt me? If she suspected he was even remotely interested, she'd do everything in her power to steal him for herself. I couldn't stand the thought of losing Patch, but it would kill me if I lost him to her. Overwhelmed by that sudden fear, I said, "Don't come back until you're ready to tell me what you were doing at her place." Patch impatiently pushed his way inside and closed the door behind him.
"I didn't come here to argue. I wanted to let you know Marcy ran into some trouble this afternoon."
Marcy again? Did he think he hadn't dug a deep enough hole already? I tried to stay calm long enough to hear him out, but I wanted to yell across him.
"Oh," I said coolly. "She was caught in the crossfire when a group of fallen angels tried to force a Nephil to swear fealty inside the men's room at Beau's Arcade. The Nephil wasn't 16, so they couldn't force him, but they had fun trying. They cut him up pretty bad, and broke a few ribs. Enter Marcy. She'd had too much to drink and walked into the wrong restroom. The fallen angel standing guard pulled a knife on her. She's at the hospital, but they'll release her soon. Flesh wound."
My pulse jumped, and I knew I was upset that Marcy had been knifed, but that was the last thing I wanted to reveal to Patch. I crossed my arms stiffly. "Gee, is the Nephil okay?" I vaguely remembered Patch explaining some time ago that fallen angels can't force Nephilim to swear fealty until they're 16. Likewise, he couldn't sacrifice me to get a human body of his own until I turned 16. 16 was a darkly magical, even crucial age in the world of angels and Nephilim. Patch gave me a look that held the tiniest glare of disgust.
"Marcy may have been drunk, but chances are she remembers what she saw. Obviously you know fallen angels and Nephilim try to stay under the radar, and someone like Marcy, with a big mouth, can threaten their secrecy. The last thing they want is for her to announce to the world what she saw. Our world operates a lot more smoothly when humans are ignorant of it. I know the fallen angels involved."
His jaw tensed.
"They'll do whatever it takes to keep Marcy quiet."
I felt a shiver of fear for Marcy, but flushed it away. Since when did Patch care one way or the other what happened to Marcy? Since when was he more worried about her than me?
"I'm trying to feel bad," I said, "but it sounds like you're concerned enough for the both of us."
I jerked on the doorknob and held the door wide. "Maybe you should go check on Marcy. See if her flesh wound is healing properly." Patch pried my hand loose and shut the door with his foot.
"Bigger things than you, me, and Marcy are going on. He hesitated as if he had more to say, but closed his mouth at the last moment.
You, me, and Marcy? Since when did you start putting the three of us in the same sentence? Since when does she mean anything to you? I snapped.
He cupped a hand over the back of his neck, looking very much like he knew he should choose his words carefully before answering.
Just tell me what you're thinking, I blurted. Spit it out. It's bad enough that I have no idea what you're feeling, let alone what you're thinking.
Patch looked around as if he was wondering whether I was talking to someone else.
Spit it out?
He said, his tone darkly incredulous, maybe even annoyed.
What does it look like I'm trying to do? If you'd calm down, I could. Right now you're going to turn hysterical, regardless of what I say.
I felt my eyes narrow.
I have a right to be angry. You won't tell me what you were doing at Marcy's last night.
Patch threw his hands up. Here we go again, the jester said.
2 months ago,
I began, trying to inject pride into my voice to hide the quaver in it. V, my mom, everyone warned me that you were the kind of guy who sees girls as conquests. They said I was just another notch on your belt, another stupid girl you'd seduce for your own satisfaction. They said the moment I fell in love with you was the moment you'd leave. I swallowed hard. I need to know they weren't right. Even though I didn't want to recall it, the memory of last night resurfaced with perfect clarity. I remembered the whole humiliating scene in vivid detail. I'd said I loved him, and he'd left me hanging. There were 100 different ways to analyze his silence, none of them good. Patch wagged his head in disbelief.
You want me to tell you they're wrong? Because I get the feeling you aren't going to believe me no matter what I say.
He glared at me.
Are you as committed to this relationship as I am?
I couldn't not ask it. Not after watching everything come tumbling down since last night. I suddenly realized I had no idea how Patch really felt about me. I thought I meant everything to him. But what if I'd only seen what I wanted? What if I'd grossly exaggerated his feelings? I held his eyes, not about to make this easy on him, not about to give him a second chance to skirt the issue. I needed to know. Do you love me?
I can't answer that,
he said, startling me by speaking to my thoughts. It was a gift all angels possessed, but I didn't understand why he was choosing now to use it.
I'll stop by tomorrow. Sleep well, he added curtly, heading for the door.
When we kiss, are you faking it? He stopped short, another disbelieving shake of his head.
Faking it?
When I touch you, do you feel anything? How far does your desire go? Do you feel anything close to what I feel for you?
Patch watched me in silence. Nora, he began. I want a straight answer.
After a moment, he said,
Emotionally, yes.
But physically, no, right? How am I supposed to be in a relationship when I have no idea how much it even means to you? Am I experiencing things on a whole different level? Because that's what it feels like. And I hate it, I added. I don't want you to kiss me because you have to. I don't want you to pretend it means something when really it's just an act.
Just an act? Are you listening to yourself?
He tipped his head back against the wall and gave another darker laugh. He cut me a sideways glance.
Are you done with the accusations?
You think this is funny? I said, hit by a fresh wave of anger.
Just the opposite.
Before I could say more, he turned toward the door.
Call me when you're ready to talk rationally.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means you're crazy. You're impossible.
I'm crazy? He tipped my chin up and planted a quick, rough kiss on my mouth.
And I must be crazy for putting up with it.
I pulled free and rubbed my chin resentfully. You gave up becoming human for me, and this is what I get. A boyfriend who hangs out at Marcy's but won't tell me why. A boyfriend who walks out at the first hint of a fight. Try this on for size. You're a jerk.
Jerk.
He spoke to my thoughts, his voice cold and cutting.
I'm trying to follow the rules. I'm not supposed to fall in love with you. We both know this isn't about Marcy. This is about how I feel about you. I have to hold back. I'm walking a dangerous line. Falling in love is what got me in trouble in the first place. I can't be with you the way I want.
Why did you give up becoming human for me if you knew you couldn't be with me? I asked, my voice wobbling slightly, sweat prickling the palms of my hands. What did you even expect from a relationship with me? What's the point of... My voice caught and I swallowed without meaning to. Us. What had I expected from a relationship with Patch? At some point, I must have thought about where our relationship was headed and what would happen. Of course I had. But I'd been so frightened by what I saw coming that I'd pretended the inevitable away. I'd pretended a relationship with Patch could work, because deep inside, any time with Patch had seemed better than nothing at all. Angel. I looked up when Patch spoke my name in my thoughts. Being close to you on any level is better than nothing. I'm not going to lose you. He paused, and for the first time since I'd known him, I saw a flicker of worry in his eyes. But I already fell once. If I give the archangels cause to think I'm even remotely in love with you, they'll send me to hell. Forever. The news hit me like a blow to the stomach. What? I'm a guardian angel, or at least so I've been told. But the archangels don't trust me. I have no privileges, no privacy. Two of them cornered me last night for a talk, and I walked away with the feeling that they want me to slip up again. For whatever reason, they're choosing now to crack down on me. They're looking for any excuse to get rid of me. I'm on probation, and if I screw this up, my story doesn't have a happy ending. I stared at him, thinking he had to be exaggerating, thinking it couldn't possibly be that bad. But one look at his face told me he'd never been more serious. What happens now? I wondered out loud. Instead of answering, Patch sighed with frustration. The truth of the matter was, this was going to end badly. No matter how much we backpedaled, stalled, or looked the other way, one day, all too soon, our lives would be ripped apart. What would happen when I graduated and went off to college? What would happen when I followed my dream job to the other side of the country? What would happen when it came time for me to marry or have kids? I wasn't doing anyone a favor by falling in love with Patch more every day. Did I really want to stay on this road longer, knowing it was only going to end with devastation? For one fleeting moment, I thought I had the answer. I'd give up my dreams. It was as simple as that. I shut my eyes and let go of my dreams like they were balloons on long, thin ribbons. I didn't need those dreams. I couldn't even be sure they'd come true. And even if they did, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life alone and tortured by the knowledge that everything I'd done meant nothing without Patch. And then it hit me in a terrible way that neither of us could give up everything. My life would continue marching into the future, and I didn't have the power to stop it. Patch would stay an angel forever. He would continue the path he'd been on since he fell. "Isn't there anything we can do?" I asked.
"I'm working on it."
In other words, he had nothing. We were trapped on both sides, the archangels applying pressure from one direction and two futures headed in vastly different directions from the other. "I want out," I said quietly. I knew I wasn't being fair. I was protecting myself. What other option did I have? I couldn't give Patch a chance to talk me out of it. I had to do what was best for both of us. I couldn't stand here, hanging on, when the very thing I held disappeared more with each passing day. I couldn't show how much I cared when it was only going to make things impossibly hard in the end. Most of all, I didn't want to be the reason Patch lost everything he'd worked for. If the archangels were looking for an excuse to banish him forever, I was only making it easy. Patch stared at me like he couldn't tell if I was serious.
"That's it? You want out? You got your turn to explain yourself, which I don't buy, by the way, but now that it's my turn, I'm supposed to just swallow your decision and walk out?"
I hugged my elbows and turned away. "You can't force me to stay in a relationship I don't want."
"Can we talk about this?"
"If you want to talk, tell me what you were doing at Marcy's last night." But Patch was right. This wasn't about Marcy. This was because I was scared and upset with the deal that fate and circumstance had cut both of us. I turned back to see Patch drag his hands down his face. He gave a short, unamused laugh. "If I'd been at Rickson's last night, you'd wonder what was going on," I flung back.
"No," he said, his voice dangerously low. "I trust you."
Afraid I'd lose my resolve if I didn't act immediately, I smacked the heels of my hands against his chest, knocking him back a step. "Go," I said, tears making my voice rough. I have other things I want to do with my life, things that don't involve you. I have college and future jobs. I'm not going to throw it all away on something that was never meant to be.
Patch flinched. Is this what you really want?
When I kiss my boyfriend, I want to know he feels it.
As soon as I said it, I regretted it. I didn't want to hurt him. I just wanted to get this moment over with as quickly as possible before I unraveled and broke down sobbing. But I'd gone too far. I saw him stiffen. We stood face to face, both of us breathing hard. Then he strode out, yanking the door shut behind him. Once the door was closed, I collapsed against it. Tears burned at the back of my eyes, but not a single drop fell. I had too much frustration and anger clashing around inside me to feel much of anything else. But I suspected, in a way that caused a sob to catch in my throat, that 5 minutes from now, when everything else had dropped away and I realized the full impact of what I'd done, I'd feel my heart breaking. Chapter 3. I lowered myself onto the corner of my bed, staring into space. The anger was beginning to wear off, but I almost wished I could stay caught up in its fever forever. The emptiness it left behind ached more than the sharp, fiery pain I'd felt when Patch walked out. I tried to make sense of what had just happened, but my thoughts were a disjointed mess. Our shouted words rang in my ears, but they echoed helter-skelter, like I was recalling a bad dream rather than an actual conversation. Had I really broken up with him? Had I really meant for it to be permanent? Was there no way around fate, or more immediately, the Archangel's threats? By way of an answer, my stomach twisted, threatening to be sick. I hurried to the bathroom and knelt over the toilet, my ears clanging and my breathing coming out shallow and choppy. What had I done? Nothing permanent. Definitely nothing permanent. Tomorrow, we'd see each other again and everything would go back to the way it had been. This was just a fight. A stupid fight. This wasn't the end. Tomorrow we'd realize how petty we'd been and apologize. We'd put this behind us. We'd make up. I dragged myself to my feet and turned on the sink faucet. Wetting a washcloth, I pressed it to my face. My mind still felt like it was unraveling faster than a spool of thread, and I squeezed my eyes closed to make the motion stop. But what about the archangels? I asked myself again. How could Patch and I have a normal relationship when they were constantly watching us? I froze. They could be watching me right now. They could be watching Patch, trying to tell if he'd crossed the line, looking for any excuse to send him to hell and away from me forever. I felt my anger reignite. Why couldn't they leave us alone? Why were they so bent on destroying Patch? Patch had told me he was the first fallen angel to get his wings back and become a guardian angel. Were the archangels angry over that? Did they feel Patch had somehow tricked them, or that he'd cheated his way back up from the bottom? Did they want to put him in his place, or did they merely not trust him? I closed my eyes, feeling a tear travel down the side of my nose. I take it all back, I thought. I desperately wanted to call Patch, but didn't know whether I'd be putting him at some kind of risk. Could the archangels listen in on phone conversations? How were Patch and I supposed to have an honest talk if they were eavesdropping? I also couldn't let go of my pride that quickly. Didn't he realize he was just as much in the wrong? The whole reason we'd fought in the first place was because he'd refused to tell me what he was doing at Marcy's house last night. I wasn't the jealous type, but he knew my history with Marcy. He knew this was the one time when I had to know. There was something else causing my insides to sicken. Patch said Marcy had been attacked in the men's room at Beau's Arcade. What was Marcy doing at Beau's? As far as I knew, nobody at Coldwater High hung out at Beau's. In fact, prior to meeting Patch, I'd never heard of the place. Was it a coincidence that the day after Patch was gazing at Marcy's bedroom window, she'd wandered through Beau's front doors? Patch had insisted there was nothing but business between them, but what did that even mean? And Marcy was many things, among them seductive and persuasive. Not only did she not take no for an answer, she didn't accept any answer that wasn't exactly what she wanted. What if this time she wanted Patch? A loud rap at the front door brought me out of my reverie. I curled up in the heaps of pillows on my bed, closed my eyes, and dialed my mom. The Parnells are here.
Ugh! I'm at the light on Walnut. I'll be there in 2 minutes. Invite them in. I barely remember Scott, and I don't remember his mom at all. I'll invite them in, but I'm not making small talk. I'll hang out in my room until you get back. I tried to convey in my tone that something was wrong, but it wasn't like I could confide in my mom. She hated Patch. She wouldn't sympathize. I couldn't take hearing the happiness and relief in her voice. Not now. Nora! Fine, I'll talk to them. I snapped my phone shut and threw it across the room. I took my time walking to the front door and flipped the lock back. The guy standing on the doormat was tall and well-built. I could tell since his t-shirt fit on the snug side and blatantly advertised Platinum Gym Portland. A silver hoop ran through his right earlobe and his Levi's hung dangerously low on the hips. He wore a pink Hawaiian print ball cap that looked fresh off a thrift store shelf and had to be an inside joke, and his sunglasses reminded me of Hulk Hogan. Despite all this, he had a certain boyish charm. The corners of his mouth turned up. You must be Nora.
You must be Scott.
He stepped inside and pulled off his sunglasses. His eyes scanned the hall leading back to the kitchen and family room.
Where's your mom?
On her way home with dinner.
What are we having?
I didn't like his use of the word we. There was no we. There was the Gray family and the Parnell family, two separate entities that happened to be sharing the same dinner table for one night. When I didn't answer, he pushed on.
Coldwater's a little smaller than I'm used to.
I folded my arms over my chest. It's also a little colder than Portland. He gave me a head-to-toe, then smiled ever so slightly.
So I noticed.
He sidestepped me on his way to the kitchen and tugged on the fridge door.
Got any beer?
What? No.
The front door was still open, and voices carried in from outside. My mom stepped over the threshold, carrying two brown paper grocery bags. A round woman with a bad pixie-style haircut and heavy pink makeup followed her in.
Nora, this is Lynn Parnell, my mom said. Lynn, this is Nora.
My, Mrs. Parnell said, clasping her hands together. She looks just like you, doesn't she, Blythe? And look at those legs, longer than the Vegas Strip.
I spoke up. I know this is bad timing, but I'm not feeling well, so I'm going to go lie down. I broke off at the black look my mom shot in my direction. I aimed my most unjust look back.
Scott has really grown up, hasn't he, Nora? She said,
very observant. Mom set the bags on the counter and addressed Scott.
Nora and I were a little nostalgic this morning, remembering all the things the two of you used to do.
Nora told me you used to try to get her to eat roly-polies.
Before Scott could defend himself, I said, he used to fry them alive under a magnifying glass, and he didn't try to get me to eat them. He sat on top of me and pinched my nose until I ran out of air and had to open my mouth. Then he flicked them inside. Mom and Mrs. Parnell shared a quick look.
Scott was always very persuasive, Mrs. Parnell said quickly. He can talk people into doing things they'd never dream of. He has a knack for it. He talked me into buying him a 1966 Ford Mustang, mint condition. Of course, he hit me at a good time. I was so guilt-ridden over the divorce. Well, as I was saying, Scott probably made the best fried roly-polies on the whole block.
Everyone looked to me for confirmation. I couldn't believe we were discussing this as if it was a perfectly normal topic of conversation.
So, Scott piped up, scratching his chest.
His bicep flexed when he did, but he probably knew that.
What's for dinner?
Lasagna, garlic bread, and a jello salad, said Mom, with a smile. Nora made the salad.
This was news to me.
I did? You bought the jello boxes,
she reminded me.
That doesn't really count. Nora made the salad, Mom assured Scott. I think everything is ready. Why don't we eat?
Once seated, we joined hands and Mom blessed the food.
Tell me about apartments in the neighborhood, Mrs. Parnell said, cutting the lasagna and sliding the first piece onto Scott's plate. How much can I expect to pay for two bedrooms, two baths?
Depends how remodeled you want, Mom answered. Almost everything on this side of town was built pre-1900, and it shows. When we were first married, Harrison and I looked at several inexpensive two-bedroom apartments, but there was always something wrong. Holes in the walls, cockroach problems, or they weren't within walking distance of a park. Since I was pregnant, we decided we needed a bigger place. This house had been on the market for 18 months, and we were able to get a deal we considered almost too good to be true. She looked around. Harrison and I had planned on fully restoring it eventually, but... Well, and then... As you know... She bowed her head. Scott cleared his throat.
Sorry about your dad, Nora. I still remember my dad calling me the night it happened. I was working a few blocks away at a convenience store. I hope they catch whoever killed him.
I tried to say thank you, but the words had broken to pieces in my throat. I didn't want to talk about my dad. The raw feelings from my breakup with Patch were enough to deal with. Where was he right now? Was regret eating at him? Did he understand how much I wanted to take back everything I'd said? I suddenly wondered if he'd texted me, and I wished I'd brought my phone down to the dinner table. But how much could he even say? Could the archangels read his texts? How much could they see? Were they everywhere? I wondered, feeling very vulnerable.
"Tell us, Nora," Mrs. Parnell said. "What's Coldwater High like? Scott wrestled back in Portland. His team won state the last 3 years. Is the wrestling team here any good? I was sure we'd faced off against Coldwater before, but then Scott reminded me Coldwater is Class C.
I was slow to pull myself out of the fog of my thoughts. Did we even have a wrestling team? I don't know about wrestling, I said flatly, but the basketball team went to state once. Mrs. Parnell choked on her wine.
Once?
Her eyes cut between me and my mom, demanding an explanation. There's a team picture across from the front office, I said. From the look of the picture, it was over 60 years ago. Mrs. Parnell's eyes stretched.
60 years ago?
She dabbed her mouth with her napkin.
Is there something wrong with the school? The coach? The athletic director?
No biggie, Scott said. I'm taking the year off.
Mrs. Parnell set down her fork with a loud chink.
But you love wrestling.
Scott shoveled in another bite of lasagna and raised an indifferent shoulder.
And it's your senior year.
So?
Scott said around his food. Mrs. Parnell planted her elbows on the table and leaned in.
So you're not getting into college on your grades, mister. Your only hope this late in the game is that a community college picks you up.
I've got other stuff I want to do.
Her eyebrows shot up.
Oh, like repeat last year?
As soon as she said it, I saw a spark of fear in her eyes. Scott chewed twice more, then swallowed hard.
Pass the salad, Blythe.
My mom handed the bowl of Jell-O to Mrs. Parnell, who set it down in front of Scott a little too carefully.
What happened last year?
My mom asked, filling the tense silence. Mrs. Parnell waved a dismissive hand.
Oh, you know how it is. Scott got into a bit of trouble, usual stuff. Nothing every mother of a teenage boy hasn't seen before.
She laughed, but her pitch was off.
Mom,
Scott said in a tone that sounded a lot like a warning.
You know how boys are,
Mrs. Parnell prattled on, gesturing with her fork.
They don't think. They live in the moment. They're reckless.
Be glad you have a daughter, Blythe.
Oh, my, that garlic bread is making my mouth water. Pass a slice?
I shouldn't have said anything, my mom murmured, passing the bread. I can't say enough how delighted we are to have you back in Coldwater. Mrs. Parnell nodded vigorously.
We're just glad to be back, and all in one piece.
I'd paused eating, dividing glances between Scott and Mrs. Parnell, trying to figure out what was going on. Boys will be boys, that much I could buy. What I wasn't buying was Mrs. Parnell's anxious insistence that her son's trouble fell into the category of typical. And Scott's close supervision of every word that fell from her mouth wasn't helping to change my mind. Thinking there was more to the story than they were saying, I pressed a hand to my heart and said,
"Why, Scott, you didn't go around at night stealing road signs to hang in your bedroom, did you?"
Mrs. Parnell erupted into genuine, almost relieved laughter. Bingo. Whatever trouble Scott had wormed his way into, it wasn't something as harmless as stealing road signs. I didn't have $50, but if I did, I would have bet it all on the hunch that Scott's trouble was anything but the usual stuff.
Well, my mom said, her smile pinched at the corners, I'm sure whatever happened is in the past. Coldwater is a great place for a fresh start. Have you registered for classes yet, Scott? Some of them fill up quickly, especially the advanced placement classes.
Advanced placement?
Scott repeated with an amused snort.
As in AP? No offense, but I'm not aiming that high. As my mom,
he reached sideways and shook her shoulder in a way that was just a little too rough to be friendly,
so kindly pointed out, if I go to college, it won't be for grades.
Not wanting to give anyone at the table a chance to pull us further away from the topic of Scott's former troubles, I said,
Oh, come on, Scott, you're killing me. What's so bad about your past? It can't be so horrible that you're not willing to tell old friends.
Nora, my mom started, get a few DUIs, steal a car, joyride. Under the table, I felt my mom's foot come to rest on top of mine. She directed a sharp look at me that said, What's gotten into you? Scott's chair scraped back against the floor, and he got to his feet.
Bathroom? He asked my mom.
He stretched his collar.
Indigestion.
At the top of the stairs. Her voice was apologetic. She was actually apologizing for my behavior, when she was the one who'd set the whole ridiculous evening up. Anyone with a shred of perceptiveness could see that the point of this dinner wasn't to share a meal with old family friends. V was right. This was a meet-cute. Well, I had news for my mom. Scott and me, not happening. After Scott excused himself, Mrs. Parnell smiled wide, as if to erase the past 5 minutes and start fresh.
So tell me, she said a little too brightly, does Nora have a boyfriend?
No, I said at the same time Mom said, sort of.
That's confusing, Mrs. Parnell said, chewing a forkful of lasagna and looking between Mom and me.
His name is Patch, Mom said.
Odd name, mused Mrs. Parnell. What were his parents thinking?
It's a nickname, Mom explained. Patch gets in a lot of fights. He's always needing to be patched up. Suddenly I regretted ever explaining to her that Patch was his nickname. Mrs. Parnell shook her head.
I think it's a gang name. All the gangs use nicknames. Slasher, Slayer, Maimer, Mauler, Reaper, Patch.
I rolled my eyes. Patch is not in a gang.
That's what you think, Mrs. Parnell said. Gangs are for inner-city criminals, right? They're roaches that only come out at night.
She grew silent, and I thought I saw her eyes flick to Scott's empty chair.
Times are changing. A couple weeks ago, I watched a Law & Order about a new breed of wealthy suburban gangs. They call them secret societies, or blood societies, or some such nonsense, but it all boils down to the same thing. I thought it was your typical sensationalized Hollywood garbage, but Scott's dad said he's seeing more of this stuff all the time. He would know, him being a cop and all.
Your husband is a cop? I asked.
Ex-husband, rot his soul.
That's enough.
Scott's voice drifted out of the shadowy hall, and I jumped. I was on the verge of wondering if he'd gone to the bathroom at all, or if he'd stood just outside the dining room eavesdropping, when it dawned on me that I didn't think he'd spoken out loud. In fact, I was pretty sure he'd spoken to my thoughts. No, not my thoughts, his mother's, and somehow I'd overheard. Mrs. Parnell flipped her palms up.
All I said was rot his soul. I'm not taking that back. It's exactly how I feel.
I said stop talking.
Scott's voice was quiet, eerie. My mom spun around as if just now noticing that Scott had entered the room. I blinked in dazed disbelief. I couldn't really have overheard him speaking to his mom's thoughts. I mean, Scott was human, wasn't he?
Is that how you talk to your own mother?
Mrs. Parnell said, shaking her finger at him. But I could tell it was more for our benefit than for any purpose of putting Scott in his place. His cold stare stayed fixed on her a moment longer, then he retreated to the front door and yanked it shut at his back. Mrs. Parnell wiped her mouth, pink lipstick staining her napkin.
The nasty side of divorce.
She let go of a long, troubled sigh.
Scott never used to have a temper.
Of course it could be that he's growing up to be his father's son.
Well, it's an unpleasant topic and not appropriate for dinner. Does Patch wrestle, Nora? I bet Scott could teach him a few things.
He plays pool, I said, my voice uninspired. I had no desire to talk about Patch. Not here, not now. Not when the subject of his name had caused a rock to swell in my throat. More than ever, I wished I'd brought my cell phone to the table. I wasn't feeling half so angry, which meant Patch had probably cooled off too. Had he forgiven me enough to send a text or call? Everything was a tangled mess, but there had to be a way around it. This wasn't as bad as it seemed. We'd find a way to work it out. Mrs. Parnell nodded.
Polo, now there's a true Maine sport.
Pool as in pool halls, Mom corrected, sounding a little pale. Mrs. Parnell cocked her head like she wasn't sure she'd heard right.
Hotbeds of gang activity, she finally said. The Law and Order I saw? Wealthy, upper-class young men were running their neighborhood pool halls like Las Vegas casinos. Best keep a close eye on that patch of yours, Nora. Could have a side to him he's keeping from you. A side he's keeping in the dark.
He's not in a gang, I repeated for what felt like the millionth time, straining to hang on to a courteous tone. But as soon as I said it, I realized I had no way of knowing for certain that Patch had never been in a gang. Did a group of fallen angels count as a gang? I didn't know much about his past, particularly before he met me.
We'll see, Mrs. Parnell said, doubtful. We'll see.
An hour later, the food was gone, the dishes were washed, Mrs. Parnell had finally left to hunt down Scott, and I retreated to my room. My cell was face up on the floor, showing that I had no new texts, no new messages, and no missed calls. My lip quivered, and I dug the heels of my hands into my eyes to stop the tears beginning to blur my vision. To keep from dwelling on all the awful things I'd said to Patch, I tried to work out in my mind a way to repair everything. The archangels couldn't forbid us from talking or seeing each other, not when Patch was my guardian angel. He had to stay in my life. We'd keep doing what we'd always done. In a couple of days after we'd shaken off our first real fight, things would go back to normal. And who cared about my future? I could work everything out later. It wasn't like I had to have my whole life planned right this moment. But there was one thing that just wasn't adding up. Patch and I had spent the past 2 months displaying our affection openly, with no reservations whatsoever. So why was he just now showing concern over the archangels? My mom poked her head inside my room. I'm going to pick up a few toiletries for my trip tomorrow. I should be back soon. Need anything while I'm out? I noticed she didn't bring up Scott as potential boyfriend material. Apparently his uncertain past had withered her matchmaking urges. I'm good, but thanks anyway. She started to pull the door shut, then stopped.
We sort of have a problem.
I let it slip to Lynn that you don't have a car. She volunteered Scott to drive you to summer school. I told her that really wouldn't be necessary, but I think she thought I was only saying no because I was worried we'd be putting Scott out. She said you could pay him back for his time by giving him a tour of Coldwater tomorrow. V gives me a ride to school. I made that clear, but she's not taking no for an answer. It might be better if you explain things to Scott directly. Thank him for the offer, but tell him you already have a ride. Just what I wanted. More interaction with Scott. I'd like you to keep riding with V, she added slowly. In fact, if Scott stops by while I'm out of town this week, maybe it's best to keep your distance. You don't trust him? We don't know him very well, she said carefully. But Scott and I used to be best friends, remember? She looked at me emphatically. That was a long time ago. Things change. My point exactly. I would just like to know a bit more about Scott before you go spending too much time with him, she continued. When I get back, I'll see what I can find out. Well, this was an unexpected turn of events. You're going to dig up dirt on him? Lynn and I are good friends. She's under a lot of stress. She may need someone to confide in. She took a step toward my dresser, pumped a dot of my hand lotion into her palm, and rubbed her hands together. If she mentions Scott, well, I'm not going to not listen. If it helps build your case that he's still up to no good, I thought he acted really weird at dinner. His parents are coming off a divorce, she said in that same carefully neutral tone. I'm sure he's going through a lot of turmoil. It's hard losing a parent. Tell me about it. The auction ends Wednesday afternoon, and I should be home by dinner. V's staying over tomorrow night, right? Right, I said, just now remembering I still needed to discuss this with V, but I couldn't imagine there'd be a problem. By the way, I'm thinking about getting a job. Better to toss it out in the open, especially since, with any luck, I hope to have employment before she returned home. Mom blinked. Where did this come from? I need a car. I thought V was fine with giving you rides.
I feel like a parasite. I couldn't even run to the store for emergency tampons without calling V. Worse, I'd come this close to having to hitch a ride to school today with Marcy Miller. I didn't want to make unnecessary demands on my mom, especially when money was so tight, but I didn't want a repeat of this morning either. I'd been longing for a car ever since my mom sold the Fiat, and seeing the cabriolet this afternoon had pushed me to action. Paying for the car myself seemed like a good compromise.
"You don't think a job will interfere with school?" Mom asked, her tone telling me she wasn't wild about the idea. Not that I'd expected her to be.
"I'm only taking one class."
"Yes, but it's chemistry."
"No offense, but I think I can handle two things at once." At that, she sat on the edge of my bed.
"Is something the matter? You're awfully snappy tonight."
I took an extra second to answer, coming very close to telling the truth.
"No, I'm fine."
"You seem stressed."
"Long day.
Oh, and did I mention Marcy Miller is my chem partner?" I could tell by her expression that she knew just how deeply this cut. After all, it was my mom I'd run home to for most of the past 11 years after Marcy had had her way with me. And it was my mom who'd picked up the pieces, put me back together, and sent me back to school stronger and wiser and armed with a few tricks of my own. I'm stuck with her for 8 weeks.
"Tell you what, if you survive all 8 weeks without killing her, we can talk about getting you a car.
You drive a hard bargain, Mom."
She kissed my forehead. "I'll expect a full report on the first couple of days when I get back from my trip. No wild parties while I'm gone. I make no promises." 5 minutes later, my mom steered her Taurus down the driveway. I let the curtain drop back in place, curled into the sofa, and stared at my cell phone. But no calls came in. I reached for Patch's necklace, still fastened around my neck, and squeezed it harder than I expected. I was struck by the horrible thought that it might be all I had left of him. Chapter 4. The dream came in 3 colors, black, white, and a wan gray. It was a cold night. I stood barefoot on the dirt road, sludge and rain quickly filling the potholes pockmarking it. Rocks and skeletal weeds sprang up intermittently. Darkness consumed the countryside, except for one bright spot. A few 100 yards off the road sat a stone and wood tavern. Candles guttered in the windows, and I was just about to head toward the tavern for shelter when I heard the distant jangle of bells. As the sound of the bells grew louder, I moved a safe distance off the road. I watched as a horse-drawn coach rattled out of the darkness and came to a halt where I'd been standing moments before. As soon as the wheels stopped rolling, the driver flung himself off the coach, splattering mud halfway up his boots. He tugged on the door and stepped back. A dark form emerged. A man. A cape hung from his shoulders, flapping open in the wind, but the hood was drawn to cover his face.
"Wait here," he told the driver.
"My lord, it's raining heavily."
The man in the cape gave a nod in the direction of the tavern.
"I have business. I shan't be long. Keep the horses ready."
The driver's eyes shifted to the tavern.
"But, milord, it's thieves and vagabonds that keep company there. And there's bad air tonight. I feel it in my bones."
He rubbed his arms briskly, as if to fight off a chill.
"Milord might be better to hurry back home to the lady and little uns."
"Speak nothing of this to my wife."
The man in the cape flexed and opened his gloved hands while fixing his gaze on the tavern.
"She has enough to worry about," he murmured.
I turned my attention to the tavern and the ominous candlelight flickering in its small, slanted windows. The roof was crooked, too, tilting slightly to the right as if the tools used to construct it had been far from exact. Weeds choked the exterior, and every now and then a rowdy yell or the sound of shattered glass traveled out from its walls. The driver dragged the sleeve of his coat under his nose.
"My own son died of the plague not 2 years past. A terrible thing what you and the lady are suffering through."
In the stiff silence that followed, the horses stamped impatiently, their coats steaming. Little puffs of frost rose from their nostrils. The picture was so authentic, it suddenly scared me. Never before had any of my dreams felt this real. The man in the cape had started across the cobblestone walkway leading to the tavern. The edges of the dream vanished behind him, and after a moment's hesitation I started after him, afraid I'd disappear too if I didn't stay close. I slipped through the tavern door behind him. Halfway down the back wall was a giant oven with a brick chimney. Various wooden bowls, tin cups, and utensils flanked the walls to either side of the oven, hanging in place on large nails. Three barrels had been rolled into the corner. A mangy dog was curled up in a sleeping ball in front of them. Overturned stools and a haphazard arrangement of dirty dishes and mugs cluttered the floor, which was hardly a floor at all. It was dirt, tamped smooth and sprinkled with what looked like sawdust, and the moment I stepped on it, the mud already caked on my heels sponged up the dusty earth. I was just wishing for a hot shower, when the appearance of the 10 or so customers sitting at various tables around the tavern penetrated my awareness. Most of the men had shoulder-length hair with odd, pointed beards. Their pants were baggy and tucked into tall boots, and their sleeves billowed. They wore broad-brimmed hats that reminded me of pilgrims. I was definitely dreaming of a time far back in history, and since the detail of the dream was so vivid, I should have had at least some idea of what time period I'd dreamed myself into, but I was at a loss. Most likely England, but anywhere from the 15th to the 18th century. I'd gotten an A in world history this year, but period clothing hadn't been on any of our tests. Nothing in the scene before me had. "I'm looking for a man," the man in the cape said to the bartender, who was positioned behind a waist-high table that I assumed served as the bar. "I was told to meet him here tonight, but I'm afraid I don't know his name." The bartender, a short man, bald except for a few wiry hairs standing on end at the top of his head, eyed the man in the cape. "Something to drink?" he asked, spreading his lips to show jagged black stumps for teeth. I swallowed the nausea that rolled through my stomach at the sight of his teeth and stepped back. The man in the cape didn't show my same revulsion. He merely shook his head. "I need to find this man as quickly as possible. I was told you'd be able to help." The bartender's rotted smile faded back behind his lips. "Aye, I can help you find him, my lord. But trust an old man and have a drink or two first. Something to warm your blood on a cold night." He pushed a small glass at the man. Behind the hood, the man shook his head again. "I'm afraid I'm in a bit of a hurry. Tell me where I can find him." He pushed a few warped tokens across the table. The bartender pocketed the tokens. Jerking his head at the back door, he said, "He keeps to the forest yonder. But, my lord, be careful. Some say the forest is haunted. Some say the man who goes into the forest is the man who never comes back out." The man in the cape leaned on the table, dividing the two, and lowered his voice. "I wish to ask a personal question. Does the Jewish month of Cheshvan mean anything to you?" "I'm not a Jew," the bartender said flatly, but something in his eyes told me this wasn't the first time he'd been asked the question. "The man I've come to see tonight told me to meet him here on the first night of Cheshvan. He said he needed me to provide a service for him, for the duration of an entire fortnight." The bartender stroked his chin. "A fortnight is a long time." "Too long. I wouldn't have come, but I was afraid of what the man might do if I didn't. He mentioned my family by name. He knew them. I've a beautiful wife and four sons. I don't want them harmed." The bartender dropped his voice, as if to share a piece of scandalous gossip. "The man you've come to see is..." He trailed off, casting a suspicious look around the tavern. "He's unusually powerful," the man in the cape said. "I've seen his strength before, and he is a mighty man. I've come to reason with him. Surely he can't expect me to abandon my duties and family for such a length of time. The man will be reasonable." "I know nothing of this man's reason," the bartender said. "My youngest son has contracted the plague," the man in the cape explained, his voice taking on a quiver of desperation. "The doctors do not think he'll live long. My family needs me. My son needs me." "Have a drink," the bartender said quietly. He nudged the glass forward a second time. The man in the cape turned abruptly from the table and strode toward the back door. I followed. Outside, I sloshed barefoot through the icy mud after him. The rain continued to pour down, and I had to walk carefully to avoid slipping. I wiped my eyes and saw the man's cape disappear into the line of trees at the edge of the forest. I stumbled after him, hesitating at the tree line. Cupping my hands to hold back my wet hair, I peered into the deep shadow ahead. There was a flash of movement, and suddenly the man in the cape was running back toward me. He tripped and fell.
The branches snagged his cape. In a frenzy, he struggled to untie it from his neck. He gave a high shriek of terror. His arms flailed wildly, his whole body twisting and jerking convulsively. I shoved my way toward him, twigs scraping my arms, rocks stabbing at my bare feet. I dropped to my knees beside him. His hood was still mostly drawn, but I could see that his mouth was slightly open, paralyzed in a scream. "Roll over," I ordered him, yanking to free the fabric trapped beneath him. But he couldn't hear me. For the first time, the dream took on a familiar edge. Just like every other nightmare I'd ever been trapped in, the harder I struggled, the more the very thing I wanted slipped out of reach. I grabbed his shoulders and shook him. "Roll over! I can get you out of here, but you have to help!"
"I'm Barnabas Underwood," he slurred. "Do you know the way to the tavern? That's a good girl," he said, patting the air as if he was patting an imaginary cheek.
I stiffened. There was no way he could see me. He was hallucinating about another girl. He had to be. How could he see me if he couldn't hear me?
"Run back and tell the barkeep to send help," he continued. "Tell him there is no man. Tell him it's one of the devil's angels come to possess my body and cast away my soul. Tell him to send for a priest, holy water, and roses."
At the mention of the devil's angels, the hairs on my arms rose. He snapped his head back toward the forest, straining his neck.
"The angel," he whispered in a panic. "The angel is coming."
His mouth twisted into distorted shapes, and it looked like he was fighting for control of his own body. He arched back violently, and his hood was flung all the way off. I was still clutching the cape, but I felt my hands reflexively slacken. I stared at the man with a gasp of surprise caught in my throat. He wasn't Barnabas Underwood. He was Hank Miller, Marcy's dad. I blinked my eyes awake. Rays of light blazed through my bedroom window. The pane was cracked, and a lazy breeze rustled the first breath of morning across my skin. My heart was still working in double time from the nightmare, but I sucked in a deep breath and reassured myself it wasn't real. Truth be told, now that my feet were planted firmly in my own world, I was more disturbed over the fact that I'd been dreaming about Marcy's dad than anything else. In a hurry to forget it, I shoved the dream aside. I dragged my cell phone out from under my pillow and checked for messages. Patch hadn't called. Drawing the pillow against me, I curled into it and tried to ignore the hollow sensation inside me. How many hours had it been since Patch walked out? 12. How many more until I saw him again? I didn't know. That was what really worried me. The more time passed, the more I felt the wall of ice between us thicken. "Just get through today," I told myself, swallowing the pebble in my throat. The strange distance between us couldn't go on forever. Nothing was going to get resolved if I hid out in bed all day. I would see Patch again. He might even stop by after school. Either that, or I could call him. I kept on with these ridiculous thoughts, refusing to let myself think about the archangels, about hell, about how scared I was that Patch and I were facing a problem neither of us was strong enough to solve. I rolled out of bed and found a yellow post-it note stuck to the bathroom mirror.
"The good news. I convinced Lynn not to send Scott over this morning to pick you up. The bad news, Lynn is set on the tour of the town. At this point, I'm not sure saying no is going to work. Would you mind taking him around after class? Keep it short. Really short." I left his number on the kitchen counter. "Hugs and kisses, Mom. P.S. I'll call you tonight from my hotel."
I groaned and lowered my forehead to the counter. I didn't want to spend 10 more minutes with Scott, let alone a couple of hours. 40 minutes later, I'd showered, dressed, and consumed a bowl of strawberry oatmeal. There was a knock at the front door, and I opened it to find V smiling.
"Ready for another fun-filled day of summer school?" she asked.
I grabbed my backpack off a hook in the coat closet. "Let's just get this day over with, okay?"
"Whoa, who peed in your Cheerios?"
"Scott Parnell."
"Patch."
I see the incontinence problem didn't go away over time. "I'm supposed to give him a tour of town after class."
"One-on-one time with a boy? What's to hate?"
"You should have been here last night. Dinner was bizarre. Scott's mom started to tell us about his troubled past, but Scott cut her off.
Not only that, but it almost seemed like he was threatening her. Then he excused himself to use the bathroom, but ended up eavesdropping on us from the hall. And then spoke to his mom's thoughts. Maybe. Sounds like he's